Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people.
Let me tell you about our guests. First of all, Lee Ortiz is an American writer, radical feminist, food activist, and radical environmentalist. Her most recent book, The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability, is an examination of the ecological effects of agriculture and vegetarianism. Keith is associated with the Deep Green Resistance Movement, and her views have attracted negative attention from some vegetarians, what one journalist has called a vegan war. Keith is currently completing a book, and this is the one we're going to be talking about today, with Derek Jensen and Eric McBay, called Deep Green Resistance Movement. Derek Jensen is an American author and environmental activist also. Jensen has published a number of books questioning and critiquing contemporary society and its values. Jensen's a leading voice of cultural dissent. He explores the nature of injustice, how civilizations devastate the natural world, and how human beings retreat into denial at the destruction of the planet. His work examines the central question: if the destruction of the natural world isn't making us happy, then why are we doing it? Jensen and Keith are authors of this book, Deep Green Resistance. Welcome, Derek and Lierre.
Well, thanks for having us on.
It's great to have you. I've been looking forward to this show. And one of the things I want to say before we start, too, is that this book has put me into a moral dilemma. You know, I've always been a proponent of nonviolent change, and I still am, but your book, Deep Green Resistance, has really challenged my core beliefs and made me look at what my true values are, what I stand for. And I think that's a good thing. And I think it's time that we all questioned our beliefs and assumptions and values and how they're driving our behavior and the destruction of our planet. So I just want to say that as a way of saying thank you also for challenging my beliefs in this. First of all, why don't each of you give us a little start of what are you talking about when you're talking about deep green resistance?
The problem with most of the solutions that are being offered to us, presented to us by the mainstream environmental movement, is that none of them actually match the scale of the problem. And what they're really trying to say to us is, how can we keep this way of life intact and yet have a living planet? And there is a profound contradiction there, because this way of life, industrial civilization, is based on drawdown. So it's drawdown of fossil fuel and, you know, things like oil and gas and coal. I think most people have heard of this somewhere. But on an even deeper level, it's drawdown of species, and it's drawdown of the oceans and of rivers and of entire ecosystems. And at this point, the planet is approaching a state of complete ecological collapse. There's nothing left to take. So this way of life cannot continue. And we're being lied to, essentially, by the people who really should be telling us the truth. So our goal in writing Deep Green Resistance was to actually propose a solution that matches the scale of the problem. And at this point, the problem is so vast that I think a lot of people just throw up their hands in despair. But if listeners walk away with this with no other kind of bullet point, I want them to understand that resistance is possible and that it's not too late to save this planet.
Derek?
Okay, so and then I would like to expand a little on what I heard Leo say there, that just one way to put this is that a question I ask all the time is, what do all of the so-called solutions to global warming have in common, and that we see in the mainstream? What they all have in common is they accept industrial capitalism and civilization as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And this is literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because without a planet, you have to have, I mean, without a planet, you don't have any social system whatsoever. And for there to be any sustainable social system, it must take the land base. The land is primary, because the land is the source of all life. And I don't mean as in a cosmic woo-woo. Well, sure, it's in a cosmic woo-woo sense, too, but just in terms of actually providing food. And if you destroy the ability of the land to provide food, that's not really a very wise move. But anyway, back to the original point, we see all the time, Lester Brown's Plan B 4.0 to save civilization. And part of the problem is that it's civilization that is actually killing the planet. And, we see this all the time. Every time Bill McKibben does an interview, he always stresses that we need to find ways to save civilization. And then you see this in really, really evil people, too, like Jay Rockefeller is, he talks about global warming, and he says, we need to make sure as we do this that we protect West Virginia's economy, which actually in his case means protect the oil companies that, gosh, what do you know, are associated with him and his friends. So the point is that when people ask, how can we stop global warming, they're not actually asking, how can we stop global warming? They're asking, how can we stop global warming without stopping the burning of oil and gas? And it's the same with salmon. When people say, how can we save the salmon, they're not actually asking, how can we save the salmon? What they're really asking is, how can we save salmon without removing dams, without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without stopping the murder of the oceans, and on and on. And the answer is you can't. I asked a 7-year-old, how do you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas? And the 7-year-old said, you stop burning oil and gas. And if you ask any reasonably intelligent 35-year-old who works for some sort of green high-tech consulting firm how you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, they'll give you a solution that A, won't work, and B, will mainly protect green high-tech consulting firms. When you were talking earlier about the question of, making you question nonviolence, et cetera, one of the central problems that we face in terms of social change is that a lot of the violence that we see around us is there's this huge gap in our understanding having to do with structural violence, that capitalism is inherently based on extreme structural violence, and so is patriarchy, and so is civilization. And something that so many people fail to understand is, or fail to recognize, fail to see, to perceive, is that, I think you can have some sort of groovy, high-speed rail transport. Well, okay, so let's say you have high-speed rail transport. Where does the steel come from? Where does the electricity come from? Well, steel comes from mines, which are incredibly violent. I mean, they destroy mountains, and they destroy the people who work in them. They're based on land theft, and so there's this tremendous violence that we don't perceive as violence that is inherent in, that is inherent to capitalism. And so one of the things that has bothered me for a long time, and this is one reason I wrote Endgame, is that there's a, that sometimes, I'm not saying you do this at all, that sometimes there are some sort of moral pacifists who claim to take some sort of high ground because they never, they'll never get their hands dirty with, anything even remotely violent in their words, but allowing a violent system to continue is in itself inherently violent. I mean, it's like slavery, slavery, which, by the way, there are more slaves in the world today than came across in the Middle Passage. What about the Indian farmers who are committing suicide because of either Monsanto or because their land is being stolen or because their aquifers are being destroyed by Coca-Cola? Does that not seem as violent?
200,000 of them in the last 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. And somehow that doesn't enter into our consciousness.
Well, this is what I love about your work, because you always take a systems approach to looking at the bigger picture. And I want to get back to this violence piece in a minute and get even deeper into that. I'd like to actually start with an operational definition of what you consider civilization to be. The dictionary calls it a highly developed society. I'd like to know what you mean, and then get into an overview of where are we in terms of civilization, kind of an overview of the state of the world right now. So could you do that, Derek?
Sure. I'll have my take, and then Lierre will probably have some things to say about agriculture, if she wants, which is related to civilization. My definition of civilization is a sort of value-neutral one, which is that civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities, and that's defensible both linguistically and historically. The word civilization comes from a word meaning city or state, and historically, that's where you really count the start of civilizations is the rise of cities. Okay, well, that's great, Derek. What's a city? A city, I've defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable, because if you're requiring the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. And that's something we actually see. That, you know, when you think of Iraq, is the first thing you think of cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's how it was prior to the arrival, to the beginnings of this culture. One of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq to make cities. And, you know, we can see this. Forests precede us and deserts dog our heels, that civilization's heels, that North Africa was heavily forested. And those forests went down for the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. Greece was heavily forested. The Near East was heavily forested. You know, all across the planet. You know, that's what this culture has been doing, is systematically working on drawdown. And one of the advantages of working on drawdown, of drawing down, of destroying your land base, is that if you convert the land into war machines, it gives you a competitive advantage over your neighbors. And that's an advantage for you. And it's also, unfortunately, you commit yourself to that path, because once you've committed yourself, once you've drawn down your own, once you've harmed your own land base, destroyed its capacity to support you, you have to continue on this path of conquest. And there's a great line by Stanley Diamond, the anthropologist, who wrote that civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home. You know, and part of the problem is that this way of life is so invisible to us, even with it killing the planet, many people still can't question this. But I want to stress that there have been thousands and tens of thousands of other ways to live. I live on Talua Indian land in Northern California, and the Talua lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talua, they lived here since the beginning of time. And the dominant culture has been here about 180 years, and the place is trashed. And when the Europeans first arrived, the place was a paradise. So my definition of civilization is, like I said, based on the growth of cities, and it's inherently unsustainable. I said there were two things that happen. One is it will be inherently unsustainable. The other is that it must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if you require being the key word, if you require the importation of resources and the people in the next watershed over aren't going to trade you for it, then you're going to take it because you require it. And this is one reason the U.S. military has to be huge, is because we could all have our own personal little epiphanies, and we could all become personally super peaceful, and here's that structural violence. The U.S. military would still have to be huge, because how else are they going to get access to the oil that they need to run the economy? I want to say one more thing, which is, in a language older than words, I talk about how the culture is really irredeemable on a psychological level, but we're all so deeply traumatized by this culture that we've forgotten what it means to be in a relationship, and we can talk about that if you want, and relationship with the natural world especially.
Let me jump to one other thing that you talked about and bring Lierre here on this, because I think it's really an important aspect of, you know, 17% of all of our greenhouse gases come from agriculture, and in the last 100 years, we've depleted 3,000 years worth of soil buildup. So, you know, that's a key issue, and Lierre, you've done huge research, and the vegetarian myth, of course, talks about this, and this has been a big area. Talk about factory farming and the impact. Oh, one other aspect of that, too. I've had a number of people on that talk about a peace diet, and that you should have a vegetarian diet because it would be better for the planet. And anytime I look at their statistics, though, it's always based on factory farming.
Correct, yes.
So give us a little overview of that and some depth of what's happening globally with the factory farming movement.
You know, you have to back it up one step because you have to understand what agriculture is before you can get into any other discussions about this. In very brute terms, you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So that's agriculture. It's biotic cleansing. That's what I call it. That's not agriculture on a bad day. That's what agriculture is. So a few problems. First is it lets the human population grow to gigantic numbers because instead of sharing that land with millions of other creatures, you're only growing humans on it. And that's a nice way to say mass extinction, okay? Because you take over entire ecosystems, which means plants and animals have nowhere else to go. That was their home, and you've turned it into a monocrop of humans. And the second big problem related is that we're destroying the topsoil. And soil is the basis of life, at least terrestrial life. We owe our entire existence to 6 inches of topsoil and the fact that it rains. So except for the last remaining tribes of hunter-gatherers, and I think there's 46 of them at this point, the human race has made itself dependent on this activity that is killing the planet. This is not a plan with the future. Okay, this is massive drawdown. And what you're drawing down is fossil soil. It's also drawdown of fossil water. It's a drawdown of species. It's a drawdown of entire ecosystems. So to give you a number on this, one season of planting your basic row crop, an annual monocrop like corn or soy or wheat, one season of that, you can destroy 2,000 years worth of topsoil. That's in one season. There were farms on the first day of the Dust Bowl in South Dakota that lost all of their topsoil in one day. Okay, so that's the level of drawdown that we're talking about. So 94% of Iran's agricultural land is degraded, and that's really where agriculture begins, is in that region. Iraq is pretty much the same. I mean, when you think of pictures of Iraq from the war, nobody in their right mind would call that place the Fertile Crescent. I mean, it's a devastated, you know, former forest. But it should be a forest. I mean, that's what it was before agriculture came. One third of Pakistan is under risk for desertification. We're basically, we've blown through all the soil on the planet. There's all the major grain growing regions of the world were essentially played out by 1950. Right now, the dust storms in China are so bad that it's actually causing asthma in children in Boulder, Colorado. That's how much dust is being released. And it was soil. Okay. Now it's dust, and it gets across the Pacific Ocean, you know, across the coastal mountains, and it finally hits the Rockies, and then it drops down into the atmosphere, and children breathe it and get asthma. And that's how bad the desertification is in China right now. So this is why various writers say that, you know, sustainable agriculture is an oxymoron. Toby Hemingway says that, Richard Manning says it, and I agree with them. This is an oxymoron. And this is the most destructive thing that people have done to the planet. I mean, I'm going to repeat that. Agriculture is the single most destructive human activity. So remember what agriculture is. You pull down a forest, you plow up the prairie, you drain the wetland, and you destroy living communities that the planet naturally creates.
Not to mention pouring poison and all of
the land. Yeah, I mean, we can even, right, exactly. And at this point, with the soil gone, of course, what we're eating instead is fossil fuel. All the fertilizer now is created by oil and gas. And that's been true since 1950, since the Green Revolution. So agriculture is carnivorous. What it eats is entire ecosystems, and that's what it's done across the globe. We are now at the end point of that because there are no new continents. And just to state the obvious, no culture that's destroying the basis of life itself can be called sustainable. I mean, really, this can only be called insane. So we're pretty well done. You know, we've reached the end point. Oil and gas, we've peaked, and not really sure what the people who run the planet think we're going to do next. But I really wish that environmentalists would understand the depth of the problem here, because simply switching to more agriculture is not going to save us. We actually need to be restoring those grasslands and those forests and those wetlands. You know, 80% of the rivers in China no longer support life. You can go around the globe and come up with pretty much the same statistic. That's what agriculture requires. So more of the same is not going to save us. Now, if you want to talk about factory farming, you have to have all that background to really understand.
Let me ask one thing, first of all, because listening to what my listeners might be thinking, and one of the things I know about both your work is it's some of the most deeply and highly researched work around. And of course, I threw out a number there that I had, which was different than the number you put out, but I have more faith in your numbers, but I want to validate, because I think these are really important books for people to read and to study. Talk just a little bit about, maybe both of you, just for a second, and then we'll get back to the factory farming. But talk a little bit about your research methodology and how you come to conclusions of some of the numbers you're throwing out.
You know, really, you can go all the way back to people like Plato and Aristotle and Socrates. They all talk about how the natural world is being destroyed, how the topsoil is running in rivers off the hillsides and filling the rivers, killing the fish. You have all these ports across the ancient world that are literally now 10 kilometers back from where they were. And that's because the topsoil, you know, pours off the mountainsides and builds up at the mouth of rivers. And that is a process that is still underway. And so the archaeologists now can dig up these ancient, what were ports, you know, all around the Mediterranean region. And they are that far underneath, you know, the surface of the land and that far back from the water because so much topsoil has been deposited. And that was soil that once supported trees. And it was, you know, what kept the mountains green and kept the life there. So my point is that you can go back even 2,000-3,000 years and see the same process. These statistics are not hard to come by. It's just that nobody wants to ask that deeper question. So, you know, Edward Higham said the same thing in Soil and Civilization. Every 10 years, somebody writes another book about how we're running out of soil. So I'm not even using the worst statistics. I'm using kind of average run-of-the-mill statistics because I don't want to be accused of using the most extreme example. But this is, you know, it's a massive problem, topsoil loss, and it at least matches global warming in terms of the biological emergency that we're facing, but it just is not getting any press because it means we're going to have to question civilization. That's really the problem because agriculture is the basis of it, so people don't want to face it.
Derek Jensen, research methodology.
Well, that's actually changed over the years. When I wrote Language and Culture, I lived in Spokane, and I would actually for culture, I lived here part of the time, but I would go to the library and I would just bring home boxes and boxes of books, like for the chapter on how the Irish, after the American Civil War, how the Irish decided to join with the oppressive class rather than the oppressed class in the United States. I brought home 6 books on Irish immigration for that chapter, and or 10 books or something. And then I would just, you know, read through those books and find all sorts of stuff that was very interesting. And now, since I don't really live near a good library, I use the internet a lot more, which is, I was thinking about this morning, that it's easier, but also I don't get as much context because there was a lot of times that I would be going to write one thing and then I would find, you know, get sidetracked by some really interesting chapter and decide I have to write about this whole other thing, like a dog going through the forest and suddenly finding a new scent that gets all exciting. I was thinking about that this morning in terms of the internet, that it's, you know, it makes research easier and also less interesting. But so far as research methodology, it's just, honestly, a lot of it is just what comes in every day that, well, here's some research methodology for you. 5 years ago, at night, you couldn't have a human conversation because the frogs were so loud, and now the frogs are pretty much gone. Up until the year before last, every summer, there were these little blue butterflies that would be constant through a lot of the summer. Last year, I didn't see a single of those little blue butterflies. Bumblebees, they were everywhere. They're gone.
This is where you live, you're talking about.
This is where I live.
Yeah.
So for research methodology, I can just go outside. And, you know, I haven't seen a Pacific giant salamander in 8 years. And I used to see routinely, I would see a bunch of newts all through the summer. If I went outside and sat for a couple hours by a pond, I'd see 15 newts. And I think I saw a couple newts last year. You know, it's just, there's some basic research methodology for you. Or here's some research methodology. I have Crohn's disease, which is a disease of industrial civilization. And here's another one, and this will toss it right back to Lierre, that an agricultural diet, I've had a lot of memory loss the last 5 years, and I've only recently discovered it's because of the heavy carbohydrate diet that we eat. And I don't mean to get too medical on this, but this is important because, like, I knew this guy whose mother went in for a routine operation, and she died of antibiotic-resistant staph. And even given that his own mother died of that, and I was very gentle about this, and I wasn't, you know, being an ass at all, it came up a while later, he still couldn't make the connection between that and the factory farm use of antibiotics causing antibiotic-resistant staph and the overuse of antibiotics in general. And so we can talk about research methodology, but, you know, just look. migratory songbirds, you know? There's so many people. Bass. I used to see bass all the time in the evening, and I see bass a couple times a year if I'm lucky.
A lot of people don't realize they're major pollinators, too.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other thing, yeah.
Well, and having to do, once again, with research methodology, I was talking to in California, we have board of supervisors instead of county commissioners. So anywhere else in the country, just put in the word commissioner. I was talking to one of the local supervisors. I have to see him somewhere. And I was mentioning he lives not far from me. I said, have you been hearing frogs? Because I've not heard frogs the last couple of years. And he said, no, I haven't noticed at all. And most of us spend so much of our, myself included, spend so much of our time inside that, I mean, this is not our world. This is a joke that I often make is one of the reasons that we don't protect the places we live is because we don't live there. We live with Brad and Angelina. We live with, the baseball season is starting up and, you know.
Kite boy.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You know, and last night I was watching some college basketball and it just breaks my heart that there's all these people jumping up and down hoping that Kansas State beats Baylor and because it was in Kansas State. And there's like, you know, probably 30,000, 20,000, 15,000 people in the stadium all dressed in weird outfits and jumping up and down and chanting. And I guarantee that if they had a rally, and this is, you know, prime bison country, if they had a rally for prairie dogs or bison, you know, you get four people show up and they, you know, four people jumping up and down doesn't have the same effect as 15,000.
Yeah. I want to get into that a lot more later on in the conversation, but I want to get back to because of what you're saying, Lear, and the factory farming and, you know, the impact of the way they're kept, the way they're fed, antibiotics, you know, all of the different things we do in factory farming. Can you give us an overview of that so we get a clear picture of what we're talking about?
Sure. I don't think there's anybody who could make a moral argument for factory farming. It's, you know, hell on earth for the animals. It's immensely destructive to water. It takes an incredible amount of energy, you know, to produce all of this. So I think that there's a really basic level that we should all be on the same side. Anybody who cares about the environment or cares about even just basic compassion should know that this is not something that anybody should be supporting. And I mean, I was a vegan for 20 years, so I want everybody to hear that I've really been as far into that world as anybody could be. And it becomes a very primary part of your identity, you know, when you take that up. And that's part of the problem is that when it stops working for you, when you get information that questions it, or when your health starts to degenerate, it's really hard to question something that's become your identity because it feels like a threat to your very self. And that's ultimately why I ended up writing the book that I did, because I wanted somebody to speak to the people in that world. Because the values are right, and those are the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. So compassion and justice and sustainability, anything that questions human hubris, okay, those are really profoundly important values for the new culture that we need. The problem is information, okay? There's this very deep lack of information in our culture about the nature of agriculture. So having said all of that, factory farming began in the 1950s, and the reason that it became possible to do was because of the Green Revolution. So what happened with the Green Revolution was something called the Haber-Bosch process. And this essentially takes natural gas and oil as feedstocks, and takes a tremendous amount of energy to do this process, but you can get nitrogen out of it. And that's really the point. It was developed in World War I to help the Germans make explosives. And then eventually, you know, the technology keeps evolving, and by 1950, they realized they could take munitions factories and turn them into fertilizer factories. So when I talk about agriculture as a war against the planet, this is not a metaphor. It takes 4,000, the energy equivalent of 4,000 Nagasaki bombs to do agriculture in Iowa right now. The average American farm takes 3 to 4 tons of TNT. That's how much energy they use per year. And so this is a war, and that's what happens when you fight the planet. It takes that much energy. So having developed the Haber-Bosch process and a way to make nitrogen fertilizer, more corn was produced in this country than could ever be used. I mean, there's just mountains surplus of the stuff, and nobody knew where to put it. With the price that low, it suddenly makes economic sense that you could take animals off the land, stick them essentially in cities, in giant concrete containers, and feed them corn. Corn is not their natural diet. They die from it. Within 60 days, most of them are dead. And that's why they spend so little time, actually, in feedlots, is because it kills them. Corn is way too acid for the stomach of ruminant. And most of them go to their death with either holes in their stomachs or tremendous damage to their livers. This is because it's not their natural diet. What does happen on corn, though, is that it makes them really fat really fast. And in a capitalist world, that means money. And that's what all of this is about. It has nothing to do with the nature of cows. It has nothing to do with the nature of a small family farm. It has to do with the nature of capitalism, which is cheap, fast, and dirty. And that's what was created. And that is the food system that we are stuck with right now. This is certainly not an excuse for anybody to use, you know, to buy factory-farmed meat. I know we all do the best we can. Sometimes it's the only option. But refraining from eating factory-farmed meat will not stop a single farmer from overproducing corn. On a political level, we've had this backwards for probably 30 or 40 years now. The reason that corn is being produced at that level is because essentially six corporations control the world's food supply. They have a monopoly, and they can drive the price of corn below the cost of production. And that means that every year, farmers are in this horrible position. They have to keep producing more in order to try to make their ends meet. The more they produce, the more surplus that is. And then the cheaper it gets the next year, which means they have to overproduce one more time. And those mountains of corn really have nowhere to go. And so this is why factory farming developed. So
not to mention the subsidies that are keeping that whole system going, too.
Yes, all of those subsidies are our tax dollars at work. It's basically billions of dollars, because what the grain cartels are willing to pay for that grain with their monopoly will not keep anybody in business. You will lose money every year as a farmer. So the U.S. government steps in every year and makes up the difference with subsidies. Okay, this is a really sick system, and we are going to have to understand it if we're going to dismantle it, because it's destroying rural communities. Suicide is now the number one cause of death for farmers in the United States. Suicide. It's the same in India, and it's for the same reason. It's because those six corporations literally control the world food supply. And with the corn subsidized, the giant corporations like, you know, Cargill and Continental, they call it agricultural dumping. They go around the world to poor countries, they flood the market with these cheap grain commodities, and they drive the local farmers out of existence. And this has, of course, accelerated since things like NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, but this process has been, in process since 1950. And this has created just vast amounts of poverty across the third world, because your only hope, of course, is to have local self-sufficient communities with their own food supply, and that has been utterly destroyed by American corporations. So, you know, withdrawing from factory farming is certainly a moral thing to do. It's not going to rearrange the real problem, which is a gross disparity of power. We are going to have to take on those six corporations, and we are going to have to dismantle those systems of power in order to make global justice happen.
We're going to get to that part in a minute, but I just want to give a plug for your book also. It's just a brilliantly researched and written book, The Vegetarian Myth. We will put you on a wait list to be the first to get Deep Green Resistance when it comes out. From what I know, is the reason is it's still, because it's such a controversial book, the lawyers are reviewing it and deciding it, because it's very powerful, and I just finished it at 3 o'clock this morning.
Thank you.
It's quite a controversial and eye-opening and disturbing in a way that is waking up. So I really invite you to be on the list to be the first to get a copy of Deep Green Resistance.
Another line that I want to mention, I don't know who said this. I got this in a book from Eduardo Galeano. They asked some Brazilian general during the dictatorship how the economy was doing. He said the economy is doing well, the people not so well. And this is part of the problem, is that there's this tremendous repetition. You mentioned many times during the break the power of the corporate media, and we can talk more about that later if you want, but it gets repeated all the time. I mean, you can look through all the channels and you'll find, oh my God, the stock market's down 80 points or up 80 points, or, you know, this stock is doing this, that stock is doing that. And if what you're told constantly is that the health of your community, I'm more interested in community than economy, the health of your community is based on how high ExxonMobil stock is, then you can come to believe that. And it's just stunning how many, you know, somebody should do this, should do like Google hits for Wall Street and find out how many hits there are, and then, you know, news associated with that, and then how much, you know, 150 to 200 species went extinct today, and they won't get mentioned at all. So there's this, I want to back up a little bit. John Livingston talked about how a lot of people consider cities places of sensory overload, but he had a different perspective. He thought that they're places of sensory deprivation. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons he believed they're places of sensory deprivation is because, especially in a city, every perception that you have, I almost said input, but that would be nice machine language, wouldn't it?
It's man-made.
Is either human-created or mediated.
Mm-hmm.
And if all you perceive are human creations 24 hours a day, you can come to believe that the human creations are what is real, are all there is. And in the book Welcome to the Machine, George Drafin and I described those weird technophile people who believe that someday humans will be downloaded into a CD and then, you know, we will merge with the machine. And one of the things in the book is it's already happened. Because look around right now, you know, all the viewers and you and me, look around, how many machines are within 20 feet of you? And how many living beings that you can perceive are within 30 feet of you? And how many machines do you have a daily relationship with? Telephone, computer, car, you know, space heater, whatever. And how many non-humans, especially wild non-humans, do you have a daily relationship with? So we can come to believe that that's what's real. It's an incredibly narcissistic perspective that is reinforced more or less constantly until you can get people like Kevin Kelly write this insane book called What Technology Wants. And he seriously is asking the question. And he's not an animist. I mean, he's not somebody, you know, like, I believe that all beings are alive, and I don't like to draw the line on who is alive and who isn't. But it's like a telephone, you know? I don't know if I go that far. But, you know, as the world's being destroyed, he's asking what technology wants, as opposed to, you know, when what does a river want? What does a tree want? And so there's this absolute insanity. So I guess it's sort of a natural segue for me for you to ask about the economy and for me to talk about insanity. Because it doesn't make any sense. But the economy is one of the things. You know, that question you asked earlier, if the destruction of the natural world isn't making us happy, why are we doing it? I asked that question about the economy. It's like the point of the economy is to accumulate. The point of the economy is not to have healthy non-human communities, not to have healthy human communities. It's not to have healthy people. And when the economy, there's fire retardant in every mother's breast milk. There's fire retardant in every fetus. They recently passed a local law, an ordinance or something, in Pittsburgh, disallowing fracking within the city limits. And fracking destroys groundwater, and why would you have, and this will probably get overturned, but why, which is crazy too, but why would you have to pass a regulation saying that you can't destroy the groundwater that you drink? My voice is getting thinner and thinner here because it's, I don't know, I mean, pretty soon I'll be Mr. Helium Man or something because it's also, it's insane. I can't get over how crazy this economy is that values this. Well, okay, and one of the reasons that this happens is because those in power gain financial wealth. I mean, they've all turned the game, the world, into a giant game of risk or monopoly. And they're accumulating these abstract, you know, what is the Walton family has $83 billion? What do you do with that much money? I mean,
yeah.
Sorry,
I've
gone from good discourse to just ranting. So
I want to go back to something you said, though, Derek, and that is one of the answers to another question I have is why aren't people going into the streets and marching? Why aren't people resisting at a higher level? And part of it is this eco-deprivation that's happening from our urbanization and our living in this electronic cement world that we no longer are in touch with the cycle. People don't know the frogs aren't croaking because they're not there where the frogs used to be. And so I think it's something that's crucial. And, you know, as far as our listeners, you know, anything we can do to get out in the natural world and get back in touch with the cycles. I love your story in the book about sitting down, well, both talking to a tree and talking to a river.
You know, some people might consider that nuts. I consider that to be a very profound thing to do. When I'm up in Tuolumne Meadows or up above in the high country and I lay down on the ground, and after a while I can feel the pulse of the earth and I can hear her talking. And I think a lot of us don't take that opportunity to get out there. And I think that's a really important aspect. So thanks for bringing that up.
Well, this is honestly one thing about that, which this is huge. This is hugely important because so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really works. Another way to put this is that if you perceive the world as consisting of other beings to enter into relationship with, you will treat the world differently than if you perceive it as resources to be exploited.
Yes.
And there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at this magnificent tree — I'm outside while we're doing this interview — if when you look at this magnificent tree right here, I'm not going to feel bad because there's thousands of other trees and they call this magnificent, all the others are going to feel bad. Anyway, there's all these beautiful trees here and grasses, and I perceive them as trees. And you treat them differently if you perceive them as — how we perceive the world affects how we behave. And if you perceive the entire world as made up of resources — I get so angry when — this goes back to economics — I get so angry when you see some article in the newspaper about how some species is going extinct, and every time they have to talk about the economic value of that species. Every time. You know, salmon don't exist for their own sake, and they don't exist for the sake of the forest, and they don't exist for the sake of the ocean. But they exist so somebody can make money. That's what the economy does to everyone and everything. When I was a teacher at Eastern Washington University, one of my students said that she was majoring in human resources management. And I'm like, God, it's like I've fallen into Nazi Germany or something. This is human resource management? So everybody has turned into a resource.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I'm not a resource.
Right, nor am I. And you brought me right to something I wanted to talk with Lierre about. Lierre, talk about the violence. Talk about pornography and the relationship to legal rights and the violent subjugation of women, and what that means in terms of power over justice and cruelty. And you've written a lot about this and have a deep understanding, both experiential and observed. Can you talk a little bit about this culture of violence that we live in?
Sure. And I think, you know, Derek was touching on this when he spoke to how this culture sees trees, for instance, as just a resource. And these are not real beings into which one might enter into a relationship. And, you know, across the board, this is the kind of patriarchal culture we live in. It's a mass media-dominated capitalist, you know, form of patriarchy. And so what you're going to have, of course, is a mass media that looks like what we have, where women are simply objects on display to be used and then disposed of when men are finished with them. And so it is about the values that underlie a rape culture. And so you're going to have high rates of rape and incest and battering. And this is because women are not seen by men as human beings. They're seen as objects that are, you know, things to be owned. And then from there flows entitlement and, you know, the kinds of violent behavior that is utterly normalized across the mass media. So, you know, you've got Kanye West, who's, you know, held up as some kind of progressive rapper. The latest video is literally just dead women all over the video. That's what the video is women hanging, you know, women lying. It's just, they're dead. It's just corpses. And so that's the end point of this. You've got a dead planet. You've got dead women. You've got dead forests. You've got dead rivers. And all of this is based on the imperative violation that's built into masculinity in a patriarchal society. Men become men by proving that they're not women and then by violating. And this is the psychology that's necessary for soldiers, for instance. So it's a highly militarized society as well. But you need people who can shut off their hearts and their minds and simply behave as if other people are objects. And the psychologists call this a negative reference group. So little boys are brought up knowing that they are boys because they are not this despised other. And the despised other begins with little girls. And then once that template is in place, you can apply it to other people. So if you're white, you can apply it against black people. If you're rich, you can apply it against the poor. But the way that I see this is that the very first othering happens between boys and girls. And pornography is very key to this, especially because if you can take that political process right, of creating that hierarchy, that objectification, and you can turn it into something that feels sexual, that's sexualized, it's almost impossible to ever take that apart, because sexual pleasure is such an overwhelming experience for most people, and it's so highly pleasurable. And, of course, it feels natural, right, because it's in your body. And now you're asking people to actually take a step back and look at that response and see that it's politically motivated, that it's been created by both capitalism and patriarchy. It's really hard for people to step outside that and see it, you know, because it feels so imperative. And pornography has been immensely successful at doing that, at creating this, you know, very entrenched rape culture. Now, in other forms of patriarchy, it's going to look different. You know, if we lived in a patriarchy that was dominated by religious fundamentalism, you'd have a different form. But we live in this kind of patriarchy, and it's capitalist, and it's mass media dominated, and therefore, it's very predictable that you're going to have, you know, a $98 billion a year industry that's essentially based on turning women into orifices for men to use in whatever way they see fit. And the age boys and girls were first exposed to this has gotten younger and younger with the internet. It's highly available. It's completely anonymous. You know, you used to have to sneak off somewhere and find it. Now any 10-year-old can get access to this. And it's very frightening, the kinds of behaviors that are happening now in junior high schools and high schools, because they have become very desensitized to out and out atrocities, really sexual atrocities, that are just presented as normal now.
Yeah, you know, I just want to make an analogy to that. It's kind of like racialization. It's not that people anymore are necessarily racist, but it's embedded in the structure of our thinking. It's not that we think that we should be violent. It's that we think from a place that doesn't explore the violence that's in there. And so you're talking about some of the blatant, but if even, you know, in the advertising, through the media, in very subtle ways, it's embedded in our cultural way of viewing the world. Can you speak a little bit about the even more subtle areas of it?
Actually, I think we should pass this one to Derek, because that's what The Culture of Make-Believe was about, his book.
Oh, yeah, right.
It was about how it's, you know, it becomes so normalized that hate doesn't even feel like hate anymore.
That's the word I was looking for, normalized, yes.
Yeah.
So can Derek, pick that up, will you?
The Culture of Make-Believe, which is like a 700-page book, started off to be a 5-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups. And the first thing I did was ask the question, what is a hate group? And I went to a KKK website, and I found that they are not, according to the hate, the website, they're not a hate group, but actually a love group, because, as I say, they love whites. So either A, the KKK is not a hate group, or B, you can't trust rhetoric. Okay, well, if you can't trust rhetoric, what do you trust? And so if you go just by the numbers, and the biggest racist segregationist organization in the United States is the U.S. judicial and penal system, because it's achieved segregation of African-American males on a scale the KKK can only dream of. One-third of all African-American males in the United States between the ages of 18 and 35 are under criminal justice supervision. And in some places like Baltimore, it's up to 50%. And what I finally came to is that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. You know, when we think of hatred, we think of sort of anger and red faces. But any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It's this structural violence we were talking about earlier. It feels like economics or religion or science or the way things are. It feels like just a normalized part of life. And a couple of really good examples that have to do with pornography, really, are what do the movies On the Waterfront, V for Vendetta, Dr. Zhivago, Straw Dogs, help me out with a couple more, Lear.
Blade Runner.
Yeah, anyway, a ton of movies. What do they all have? I just saw someone Masterpiece Classic the other day. What do they all have in common? What they all have in common is the classic pornographic rape fantasy of a rape starts, and by the end of it, the woman is no longer pushing the man away, but instead pulling him close. In Dr. Zhivago, there's the scene where Evgrav is raping Lara, and at the beginning of the scene, she's pushing him away. By the end of the scene, soft focus, pull back, she's pulling him close. And what that's saying is that's reinforcing the notion that no doesn't mean no.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, Leah and I can have had friendly agreements / disagreements about this as to which is actually worse, you know, sort of the hardcore porn that's just really nasty, or this stuff that's totally mainstreamized. It's like, I've always thought that James Bond is really, really awful, and because it's this sort of mainstreamized porn. Or what about Doublemint gum ads? Double Your Pleasure, Double Your Fun. With a couple of twins with big breasts? I mean, who are we kidding? What are we selling here? Or one more is, I just noticed this recently, and Lear says it's a pattern that goes quite a ways back, but I just recently noticed it, that there are a lot of beer ads in which the whole focus of the thing is that the man chooses beer over a woman. It's like, wow, you know, in a culture where you have relationships between alcohol abuse and domestic violence, and where you actually have living, breathing women who are probably saying to living, breathing men, look, you need to quit drinking because it's destroying our family. This ad is reinforcing in a very friendly way, in a very cute way, that the men should choose alcohol over the women. Mm. And that's a pretty, there's a great line by this Scottish person, which is, if I could write all the ballads, I wouldn't care who writes the laws. Because we are storytelling creatures. I want to say one more thing about this, which is, I interviewed years ago George Gerbner, who, the acts of violence per hour, although he did say that so much TV violence creates what he calls a mean world syndrome, where we think that the world is a lot nastier place than it really is, because, you know, you can see 7 murders per hour, and I got to tell you, in my life, I've never seen a murder, you know? So you can think that it's a lot more common. It makes you a lot more scared, which, what are the political ramifications of that, which is what Gerbner was all about. But the other thing he said that's really, really important is that violence is a social relationship, and who does what to whom is the question. And so what he was really interested in is, okay, how many males commit acts of violence against females? How many white males in media, how many white males commit acts of violence against males of color? And he says that's the real question, because what it does is it reinforces your belief in how strong you are. And so, for example, you know, Bruce Willis or Sylvester Stallone, they can be in a movie and 2 minutes later, they've killed 17 people. And, oh my gosh, that's not even violent at all. That's not, doesn't warrant an oh my gosh, because, well, he's just Bruce Willis. But on the other hand, if you have a woman who is not a cop and is not La Femme Nikita, and she kills someone, then this is really outrageous. And what Gerbner always said to realize is that all these movies are the fantasies of the people who made them. And they're really the fantasies. And if they get published, if they get made and distributed, they're going to be the fantasies of those in power. And that's what the media is. I want to do one more quote here, and then I'll shut up again. That there's a great line by Henry Adams. He said, the press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. And this is absolutely true.
Say that again. It's just too good. I want people to listen to this.
Yeah. The press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other purpose than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. The press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. And this is honestly true of the, you know, infotainment news, which is nothing but an advertisement for capitalism. And it's just as true for the stories we hear, the stories we're told, whether the stories are through advertising or through films, through books. Why is Lolita a classic? In any sane culture, Lolita would be what Judith Herman calls it, which is a beautifully written apologia for child rape. How do these stories get passed into our life? How do these stories get passed into our DNA? By repetition, by hearing them all the time. And that can be done through the more overt pornography, and it can be done through these other stories. And I want to be really clear. I'm not saying anything is wrong with and George Gerbner wasn't either. There's nothing wrong with violence in a film. The question is, what are you doing with it? And what are you attempting to, what messages are you attempting to convey? What do you want people to take away from it?
Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5 Nevada City and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at arewelistening.net.